This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The first Westerner to translate Japanese stories into English was Patrick Lafcadio Hearn. Born in Greece in 1850, later abandoned by his parents, Hearn was sent to America, and he made his way to Cincinnati, and while he was here, he wrote hundreds of articles, many of them for the Cincinnati Inquirer. A selection of his work is now on display at the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County in The Strange and Exotic World of Lafcadio Hearn. Here to discuss the exhibit in Hearn's life and work are Public Library Reference Librarian Diane Malmstrom and Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Steve Kemmy. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Steve and Diane, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. I'd like to make one correction. I'm a former Cincinnati Inquirer reporter.
Okay, former Cincinnati Inquirer. All right. Okay, former Cincinnati Inquirer reporter. But you can start us off by talking about Lafcadio Hearn. I mean, this is interesting. He's born in Greece. He's raised in Ireland. He goes to school in England and France. So the question I keep asking is, wow, he's been all over the place. How does he end up in Cincinnati?
Well, he was raised by his great aunt in Dublin, and she moved in with a relative in London when Hearn was about 18, I guess. And he did not get along with this relative at all. And his aunt became ill, and some of her wealth began to decline, so she didn't have the money to send him to the university. So this distant relative, who was the financial manager for the aunt, decided that he would send him to Cincinnati because his sister and brother-in-law lived in Cincinnati. So he gave Hearn money to get on a ship and come to New York and then to Cincinnati. And when Hearn got to Cincinnati, he went to this distant relative's house and he gave him $5 and said, well, that's about it. He didn't really want any more to do with him. He had a family to support himself, and he wasn't inclined to help support this shirt-tail relative who looked really scruffy and, you know, was not exactly a real social person at that time, too.
How did he become a writer, Steve? Was he formally trained as a writer, or was this just something he kind of fell into?
He was very interested in literature and writing when he went to private Catholic schools in Dublin and in London. He may have gone to a private school in France, too. They're not really sure. But he also loved the French language. And he decided, I think when he was going to school, that he would like to go into writing. And so when he came to Cincinnati, though, he had no job prospects at all. And he wound up spending the first few months in Cincinnati essentially living on the streets. He would sleep in, you know, big cardboard boxes on sheltered doorways. And finally, he met a printer who sympathized with him. And so the printer, in exchange for doing some work at his printing shop, he let him sleep in the back room on paper shavings.
Diane, tell us about the exhibit you have at the library of Lafcadio Hearn.
Well, we have an extensive collection of Lafcadio Hearn, probably one of the largest collections of his works in the country. What we have on display is just a small portion of the collection. They are first editions of his works, and we do have four manuscript letters that he wrote. And we also have the only known original copy of Ye Gig Lamps, which was a brief serial that he did with Henry Farney, who many know also was famous as an artist here in Cincinnati. They did Ye Gig Lamps. I believe there was 9 issues, Rand?
Yes, yes.
And we have the only original copy. It has been reprinted by the library, but we have that on display as well.
And that was Hearn's own copy, too.
Yes.
In fact, he wrote his initials, LH, right at the top of stories in those issues that he had written.
What are some of the other works that you have on display?
Well, we also have a first edition of, I was mentioning to the lady outside, that he wrote the first Creole cookbook when he was in New Orleans. And we have a first edition of that Creole cookbook in this on display. We focus a lot on his time in Cincinnati with the newspaper articles and the period of the gruesome and his, you know, gory stories that he wrote. But we also have items from his time in New Orleans and the 2 years in the West Indies when he was in Martinique. That book is on display. And then on the inside in the Cincinnati room are his Japanese books and the translations of the Japanese ghost stories and fairy tales.
But he wrote a cookbook. He sounds like he was a versatile person.
Well, yeah, he got recipes from the wives of his Creole friends in New Orleans, and he collected them for this big world exposition that was going to take place in New Orleans. And he had the idea that he would make some money, and he would also promote Creole culture. And in addition to that, he also collected Creole proverbs, and he had a book about Creole proverbs at the same time. Unfortunately, those two books came out about 2 months before the expedition closed, and so he didn't make very much money from it, but they're really important books in terms of documenting, you know, Creole culture there.
How many books did he end up writing? Any idea?
I would guess about 30 or so. When he was with in Cincinnati with the Cincinnati Enquirer and another daily, the Cincinnati Commercial, he wrote more than 400 stories in about 6 years.
So he was a pretty prolific writer, it sounds
very,
like.
Very prolific, yes.
Yes, he was. And a number of his stories have been collected into books. Children of the Levee is a book that's a collection of his articles about life on the levee, which was Rat Row and what's the other area? But it was, you know—
There was also—
River Life.
Bucktown, which was the African-American neighborhood just east of Eggleston Avenue, where Eggleston Avenue is now on the riverfront. And he was the only person really writing about the African-American community and their culture at that time. A lot of his colleagues and even his editors thought that was kind of strange. They didn't really understand why he was doing that. But he really had a lot of empathy for the African Americans and a lot of respect for their music, and he would at night he would go to bars where they would have their music and dances, and he would write down lyrics to these sometimes songs from their slave years, because a lot of them at that time were former slaves.
So, as a reporter, Steve, what kinds of stories is he covering for the most part?
He covered. Initially, he was on the police beat for the most part. So he would come into work around 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and he would make rounds throughout the night. And he often would not go home until about 3 or 4 in the morning. I mean, it was he worked long and hard. But he did all kinds of stories. He did long feature stories that were featured in the Sunday newspaper. He might do a story about, you know, the cost of beer. He would do stories about how teeth were treated. He did this one investigative story about why the part of the west side of Cincinnati was filled with this horrible odor from the sewers. And he also did a lot of things about spiritualism, which at that time was in vogue. The spiritualism was something where people believed that they could have communications with the dead, and there were a lot. It produced a lot of con artists who would charge people, you know, to come to lectures or seances where they supposedly spoke to the dead. And he exposed a lot of the con artists who were doing that at the time.
So he's debunking a lot of
yes.
it. Yeah. What was his writing style like?
When he worked in Cincinnati, it was a very flowery style. He was very descriptive. And when he was descriptive to the point of gory when he wrote about crime stories. He would describe the condition of corpses that had been burned in mm-hmm. furnaces. He would describe corpses that had been dug up for evidence. And he would describe the reaction of the people when they opened the coffin. He also wrote very, very sensitive stories, too, about some of the victims of crimes. There was one little girl who was killed by her mother, and he described the body of the girl being laid out at the funeral in this dress with flowers and everything. And he did it in such a way that he really pulled you into the emotions of that event. And that was one of his great talents as a writer. He was able to pull the reader into whatever scene he was describing.
Yes. And he idolized Edgar Allan Poe. He absolutely adored Edgar Allan Poe. So that was someone he wanted to emulate. And in fact, Henry Watkins, who was the printer that took him in off the street, called him his little raven. And one of the manuscript letters we have, Lafcadio Hearn drew a little raven in the corner, a little bird. So it was his dearest friend in Cincinnati was Henry Watkins. And they continued to correspond throughout the rest of Watkins' life.
Yeah, there's a something that Hearn wrote about himself that I picked up on. He talked, and again, he's writing about himself, and it's the flowery language that you describe. But he says, now in those days, there was a young man connected with the Daily Inquirer whose tastes were whimsically grotesque and arabesque. He was by nature a fervent admirer of extremes. He believed only in the revoltingly horrible or the excruciatingly beautiful. He worshipped the French school of sensation and reveled in thrusting a reeking mixture of bones, blood, and hair under people's noses at breakfast time.
Yes.
Sounds like he knew himself pretty well.
He did.
Yeah, he did.
He had this mischievous quality about him. He wrote one story for the I'm not sure if it was the Enquirer or the Commercial, where he had heard about this beautiful model that one of the artists was using in Cincinnati, and she would pose nude. So the artist invited him to come in to observe her. Well, he wrote a story about this whole experience, and he described her body in not obscene terms or anything objectionable, but it was certainly he was pushing the envelope, and he described his own reactions to it. And he also one time dressed up as a woman in order to get into a lecture that was for women only. He put on a blonde wig, a dress, long gloves, and button boots. And he managed to pull it off.
He sounds like quite a character. Wow. How big is the exhibit that you have at the library, Diane?
Well, it's in the Joseph S. Stern Jr. Cincinnati room on the third floor connector. And the Cincinnati room is open 7 days a week. However, we do close at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And is a wall case that opens out into the hall and into the room, and then one flat case inside the room. What's in the flat case inside the room is the original copy of Ye Gig Lamps and the letters, the original manuscript letters. And then the wall case facing the hallway when people are walking by has the time that he was in the U.S., predominantly Cincinnati. And then New Orleans, and then the two books we have from his time in the West Indies. And then an inside wall case are his books from Japan.
So, Steve, after Cincinnati, he goes to New Orleans. Is that right?
Yes,
that the correct order?
In 1877, he went to New Orleans. And I should say one of the reasons that he wanted to get out of Cincinnati is that he had married an African-American woman in Cincinnati, and it was considered an illegal marriage because interracial marriages were illegal in Ohio at that time. And he was fired by the Enquirer partly because of that. And after about 2 weeks, the Cincinnati Commercial hired him. But the relationship with this woman fell apart after a few months. And he felt like he was at the end of his road in Cincinnati. He'd done about all he could do and felt to develop as a writer, he had to go elsewhere. And he wanted to go to a warmer climate. He hated Cincinnati winters. And so, and also New Orleans gave him, you know, he had the French culture, and he loved the French
language. Which is something he really loved, yeah.
So in 1877, he went to New Orleans, and he stayed there for 10 years.
So what kinds of, he's still a reporter, though, in New Orleans?
Yes, he wound up writing about 14 stories for the Cincinnati Commercial from New Orleans. They paid him kind of a freelance for those stories. And he wrote his first stories about the Creole culture, and that appeared in a Cincinnati newspaper. And he worked for a weekly called The Item, and he wrote these little short stories. Some of them were sketches. Some of them were editorials railing against the political corruption that was in New Orleans. And he also made illustrations for that weekly newspaper that made it very successful. It was kind of on its way out when he was hired, and his illustrations and writing really helped to keep it going. And then after that, he was hired by the daily newspaper in New Orleans, where he was the literary editor.
So how's he end up in Japan?
Well, he ended up in Japan he went to Japan in 1890, and he had always been interested in Asian culture. When he was in Cincinnati, he saw Japanese art, he saw Chinese art and pottery, he heard music from those cultures, and so he was always interested in it. So after New Orleans, he spent 2 years in Martinique, and he wrote a fantastic book about his experiences there. And he decided at that point he wanted to go to Japan. That was the place where he could really delve into a culture that he loved but knew very little about. And that was also a time where the Western world had great demand for knowledge about Japan, because it had only been in the 1850s that Japan had opened up its borders to foreigners. For about 200 years, they had been closed to any outside influences at all. And so he felt that it'd be a great opportunity to go to Japan and to explore that culture.
Hadn't he become a Buddhist by then? Because I remember he became fascinated by Buddhism.
He did. He was pretty much an agnostic when he was in Cincinnati and also New Orleans. But he had this spiritual side to him throughout his life. And he began reading about Buddhism. And then when he went to Japan, he would visit these Buddhist temples, talk to Buddhist priests, and just experience Buddhism through the ordinary people of Japan, and he really became a devotee of that faith.
Well, and then he became an icon in Japan.
Oh, he did.
Absolutely.
Yes, he it's funny. I was in Japan in 2004 for a Hearn symposium, and this taxi driver in Tokyo asked me, he knew a little English, he asked me why I was there, and I said, oh, I'm here for the Lafcadio Hearn Symposium. And he smiled and said, ah, ghost stories. Because Japan is, Hearn is famous in Japan for retelling ancient Japanese folk tales, which a lot of times have to do with ghosts and, you know, spiritual kinds of things. And he really helped to preserve Japan's ancient culture and to make the modern Japanese society more aware of their own cultural background.
And don't they have a memorial garden of some type to him in Japan?
Oh, they have
a museum.
They have gardens.
A museum.
There's also a Lafcadio Hearn Museum in the city of Matsue, which is on the west coast of Japan, and that's right next to the samurai house that he had lived in. And they've preserved the samurai house just as it was when he lived there.
Yes, his great-grandson is the director of the museum, and he was in town earlier this year visiting Cincinnati and New Orleans because they're ramping up for a big anniversary.
It would be the 150th anniversary of Hearn's arrival in the United States. That'll be in 2 years. And so his great-grandson, Bon Koizumi, was in town with his wife, Shoko, to look at some of the Hearn-related sites here and then also to talk to Hearn aficionados here in Cincinnati about doing something, you know, to celebrate Hearn for this 150th anniversary.
Didn't he have a Japanese name as well?
Yakumo Koizumi. Koizumi was his wife's family's name. And he took the name and became a Japanese citizen so that his wife and children would inherit his property and his money when he died.
And I meant to ask you this earlier too, Steve, that Lafcadio is such an unusual name. Where did that come from?
Well, he was born on the Greek island of Lefkada. And so his parents decided to incorporate his Irish culture and his Greek culture in his name. So his formal name was Patrick Lafcadio Hearn.
And Diana, I'm just amazed by how well-traveled he was.
Yes, it is amazing, truly amazing. And when he first went to Japan, a number of his articles that he wrote were published in the Harper's Weekly, and he would get paid for different articles and materials here in the States for when he was in Japan. And what I found fascinating was he was so interested in the culture, and yet he taught English to the Japanese boys. And at that time, girls didn't go to school. It was all boys in the classroom. But Dr. Tanaka loaned us a book. It's not on display, but if anyone would like to see it, one of a student had collected works that he had taught from.
Yeah. Hearn was a beloved teacher at the University of Tokyo. There came a point where the university, after Hearn became a Japanese citizen, the university wanted to reduce his pay because foreigners were paid higher than native teachers were. And they got into a real tussle over salary. And so Hearn wound up resigning. He was sort of forced to resign. And his students were so angry, they wanted to stage a public protest, which at that time in Japan was almost unthinkable that something like that would happen. But Hearn talked him out of it. He told him, no, that's all right. And he wound up teaching the last 2 years of his life at Wasada University, which is also in Tokyo.
The strange and exotic world of Lafcadio Hearn. Diane, how long is the exhibit going to be on display?
It's up through August 20th, and we're having a wonderful talk on July 15th, a week from Saturday, 2 p.m., with Steve Kimmy and John Hughes. And they'll be discussing Lafcadio Hearn from Cincinnati Ghouls to Japan's Ghosts.
That's right.
Plenty to talk about with this gentleman, isn't there? Well, Diane and Steve, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Public Library Reference Librarian Diane Malmstrom and former Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Steve Kimmy. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.